There's me, Julie Etchingham, who's very recognisable, the producer and the cameraman, just all lights blazing, you know, recording. And it was a US Marine Corps toilet tent. And there was a poor chap sat there doing a number two, reading Stars and Stripes, looking up over his paper. What is this? And I'm there in my British uniform, like, hi, can we just borrow your tent? Sorry. And so, yes, so we obviously let him finish his business. And I was quite smug for about 10, 15 minutes because I thought, I've just saved everybody from the fire and the dust storm. But of course, you know, what is a dust storm? It's wind. What does wind do to a fire? It moves it. And so as the tent started to get a bit warmer and fill up with smoke, I was like, this might not be as safe as I thought.
Hello and welcome to the Women of the Future podcast, a podcast made in collaboration with the Women of the Future programme, a platform built to unlock a culture of kindness and collaboration among leaders, as well as support and celebrate the successes of women. I'm Kim Rowell and I won the media category at their awards in 2018 in recognition of my continued work as a commissioner, producer and children's author, particularly within the mental health remit. I'll be talking to my guests on this podcast about their careers, who or what gave them their first big break, their successes, failures and inspirations along the way, and how they came to be a part of the Women of the Future network. Leslie Wood's 20-year career in public relations has taken her around the world, adeptly combining her Chief Communications Officer Ministry of Defence day job with serving as a squadron leader in the RAF Media Reserves. Leslie has worked with international partners and film industry collaborators to shine a light on the work of her military colleagues. As a serving senior Royal Air Force Reserve media officer, her operational experience equips her with unique perspectives that informs her civil service role, where she leads campaigns for the MOD Communications Directorate. Leslie's keynote speeches and masterclasses cover everything from what climbing a tree for Tom Cruise taught her about leadership, to why saving a TV documentary crew from a burning tent in Afghanistan made her a better communicator. A compelling organisational storyteller in creating and curating compelling reflections of her own experiences on a broad range of topics, Leslie is quite remarkable in lending a voice to those who serve.
So I'm actually the third generation of women in my family to serve in the UK Armed Forces. So I kind of sort of come from a long legacy of women doing awesome things and running around the world saving things. My gran was an ambulance driver in World War II, which is how she met my granddad, who was in the army. And then fast forward sort of some years, my mum in the 1960s was the poster girl to help recruit into the Women's Royal Air Force. It was called the Women's Royal Air Force, not the real Royal Air Force. So it was separate until the 1990s, which is not something that everybody knows about. And so I kind of sort of feel like they were ahead of their time. They were female influencers. So I'm third generation female influencer for the military, which is quite cool. I'm quite proud of that legacy.
And did you know that that was what you were always going to do from a small child? Or did you have aspirations to do anything else?
I only really love two things, the military and history. So there's pictures in my family album of me very, very little dressing up. And both my parents served, my mum and my dad. So I would be forever dressing up in their uniform hats, all that kind of stuff. And there's pictures of me. And then as soon as my little brother was born, 5 years younger than me, I had somebody to give orders to. So I was, I was literally going around learning how to be bossy, if you want to go the negative side, from a very early age. But I did love my history. And my parents were very good at taking me around all the places to sort of say, this is what happened here. And, you know, showing me all that kind of stuff. So if I hadn't have joined the military, I think I would have probably been a historian or possibly worked for the National Trust or done one of those amazing tele programs like the Tower of London, where you see all these historians get access to all these really cool places. So
I don't think it's bossy either. I think it's leadership skills. You obviously had leadership skills really early on.
That's really at age five.
Exactly. What were you like at school? Were you quite academic? Were you quite dedicated to your studies? Was it more about the extracurricular side? What were you like as a student?
My school years were a bit special in that I was a boarder. So my parents were based in RAF Germany at the time. So from 11 to 18, which is kind of like a 7-year prison sentence, I went to a boarding school. It was a great school. I mean, academically, it was very strong, but I really struggled the first couple of years. And so 11 and 12, I was quite badly bullied. I was a very small, you grew up on a military base, you're quite sheltered. So when your parents are like, here you go, big school. And then you're like, oh, where have you gone? You're in another country. And so that was actually quite a harsh learning curve for me, although it did teach me a lot of resilience now. And I'm actually quite grateful for it looking back. At the time, it was quite crap.
Yeah, I can imagine. I've heard different stories about people's boarding school experiences. Some people really thrive, but I mean, it's very dependent, isn't it, on the situation, where you are, the time of life, all of those kind of things. And it sounds like you had a bit of a torrid time of it. I'm sorry to hear that.
It was a great school. I mean, I think the problem is that when you're a little kid, and I'm probably going to show my age now, I used to read Enid Blyton. So the Mallory Towers was the series about a boarding school, and obviously Secret Seven, Famous Five, having adventures. So I was an avid reader. I think I was actually reading before I could walk, Mum used to say. And so I was consuming all of these books thinking, yeah, I'm going to have my big adventure. You know, this 11-year-old little kid. My actual trunk, which ironically I've still got in the back of the house, my boarding school trunk packed with all my uniform, was bigger than me. And I was having to fly through Heathrow Airport all alone, literally with this giant trunky thing. And so I think because I'd grown up in that sort of family where I was a bit sheltered, it was a bit weird for me the first couple of years. But you learn the resilience, and at the end of it, I was head girl of the school. So you kind of find your way literally through, as the RAF's actual motto is, through adversity to the stars. So you can literally grow through the difficult stuff, which you're never grateful for at the time. But when you learn that resilience early on, I've literally been able to bounce around the world and not feel too scared now.
That's really interesting. It's made you into who you are, essentially. But that love of reading, you studied English language and literature, didn't you?
Yes.
Was that part and parcel of why you just wanted to like completely immerse yourself in that side of your character and just embrace it all?
I think it's, so I refer to myself now as an organisational storyteller. I've always loved stories. So my mum tells the story that my first word was why. Not mum or dad or food, but why. So I was always like, why? But why, mummy? Why? Or, you know, and so I was forever interrogating neighbours about what was going on. And so I think I was an early leanings towards sort of being a journalist or something like that. And I just loved the whole stories. And as I grew up and started reading more personal development books and sort of leadership books and things, there's a particular book that I love, Brené Brown's Atlas of the Heart, where in one of the later chapters, she talks about having the courage to walk alongside somebody else and share their story and not make it about you. And I thought, she's literally summing up my career. So yeah, I think it's something you kind of learn. I also used to write for the school magazine, which I loved. I used to narrate in school plays and things like that. So I think I found my voice quite early on.
That's really interesting. And also your first, or you spent 5 years, I was really interested to read this, you spent 5 years at Global, which is a big media brand, as a public relations manager, which is combining those two things, really, isn't it? Like finding your voice and then your love for writing and creative and storytelling. Is that why you went down that avenue? And was that a first job out of uni? Was that your first foray into this area?
It was one of my early jobs, yeah. So I used to work at, it was called Radio Broadland at the time, Broadland 102, it's now Heart FM Norfolk. So it changed ownership a few times. But I absolutely loved it because you are there literally telling stories on air, going out. And I was working with the promotional team. So we were the first of all of those stations to have, it used to be called the Black Thunder team, the promotional team. I think they're called Heart Angels now.
Yeah.
And they used to have the little t-shirts with the little station logo on them, and they had the little branded cars and stuff. And because you're based in Norfolk, I was sort of always looking, I was always hustling for the opportunity. And Norwich Airport had a firm called Sterling Aviation who used to fly helicopters. Now, I would often see them. We'd go and do a live outside broadcast like the Royal Norfolk Show or something. And I would see Sterling Aviation offering helicopter flights for like, you know, 10 minutes, 20 quid, whatever it was. And I was literally putting two and two together, outside broadcast stand, helicopter. And the helicopters are painted black, which is a really big indicator that I could just do something. So I developed my first ever PR partnership, where I suggested that we put like a sort of giant, you know, magnetic decal on the side of the radio station logo. And so we would make it the Black Thunder helicopter. So we were the first radio station in the whole of the UK that had a helicopter in its fleet. I did a photo shoot down Norwich Airport runway, where you had all these big, you know, Humvee sort of Black Thunder vehicles and the helicopter hovering overhead, looking like something out of Top Gear. And this is a long time ago. This is quite ahead of the game. So I've kind of found my, oh, I like this. This is fun. I like playing with this sort of thing. So yeah, it was cool.
That does sound, I mean, those budgets now just don't exist, but it sounds like you used your initiative more than actually
There was
trying
no
to,
money.
like, exactly acquire the money. You literally was like, hang on a sec, we've got this, we can do this, this is my idea. So how then do you marry that up with a career in the armed forces? How did that manifest itself?
So I was actually working in that radio station when I heard that they have reserve public relations officers. So the Royal Air Force, in fact, all three services, they don't have a permanent branch for media and communications. So you can't join the military permanently as a media and comms officer. You have to be a reservist. So it's like a specialist branch that only does sort of part-time volunteer reserve service. So I heard from a friend who was a reservist as an RAF regiment officer, and he said, "Oh, you know, there's a media squadron." And I was like, "What? No, really?" This is about 18 years ago. So I went down and I listened to what they had to say, and I thought about it, and I was like, "This is actually quite cool. I can still do a military thing and keep my love for doing media and comms and only sort of dip in and be, you know, be the specialist that I wanted to be without sort of becoming a generalist." And I've served almost 18 years since.
That's really quite an incredible career. And now you combine being the chief comms officer for the Ministry of Defence, which is your day job, inverted commas, with serving as a squadron leader. Is that still the case?
Yes,
That's what you
so
do.
the part-time reserves job, over that time I've obviously got promoted and had various opportunities, deployed to Afghanistan, etc. So I'm now a serving squadron leader, part-time volunteer reserve, which is literally one weekend a month, several days a year. You're looking at about sort of, you know, 28, 35 days commitment a year or more if you want to. And then my day job as a civil servant, I'm now the head of partnerships in the Ministry of Defence's Directorate of Defence Communications, which is a brand new role which has just been created. And we are now that sort of Black Thunder helicopter thing that I mentioned. I'm now doing that at scale, and it's marvelous. It's so much fun. We've just had a British Army colleague win Traitors, but we've
Oh,
got an
okay.
army guy on Gladiators. We have members of our armed forces taking part in Britain's Got Talent. We're doing a film with BBC's Comic Relief. We're literally, these are all the things that I'm now working on, which is like the ideas have just gone crazy. My boss, my director, actually says, "No idea too crazy, Leslie." And I'm like, "Really? Thanks."
Yes, they don't say that.
Yeah.
Let's see where it can go. I mean, when you look at the things that you've done and the things that you now speak about as well. I want to ask you like a million questions, but you said here, like, what climbing a tree for Tom Cruise taught
Taught me
me
about
about,
leadership.
yeah. And then also, why saving a TV documentary crew from a burning tent in Afghanistan made me a better communicator, which I'm laughing at, but I can imagine in that moment when there's a tent
It
on
was quite scary.
fire in a war-torn country, you're like, okay. So I suppose there's an element of comedic value, but is that just as a hook because you're kind of piquing people's interests? And like you say, these are entertainment things, aren't they? They're things that people already invite into their homes on a Saturday night potentially. And you've worked with James Bond as well. But I suppose my question is for you, is that part of the excitement? Is that what keeps life interesting? The fact that it's quite varied and it's challenging and you're having to think about how to navigate all of these things.
So yeah, I can share with you that sort of brief story of the lovely Julie Etchingham from ITV's News at 10 and my good self. Early on in my career, I was deployed to go to Afghanistan with her and with a two-man crew to make a 30-minute documentary for ITV Tonight called Women on the Front Line.
Right.
And it was very well scoped out. We would be in Afghanistan for a little over 2 weeks, and we had all these interviews set up with women doing all these jobs everywhere. And it was all going swimmingly. It was all going fine until the day that something caught fire. And of course, ITV news crews, being ITV news crews, as I'm sure you know and your good self, they were like, "Oh, there's a story over there. Should we go and film it?" And then 18 hours later, we're caught in this massive, just raging fire of that no one ever saw coming. And so what had happened was something on a neighboring camp next to the British camp, the American camp, had caught fire. And so we were going over to film what was going on. Night had fallen by this time. And, you know, TV cameras going over there, see what's going on, get a bit of footage, bit of background. And there was a dust storm coming in, which, if you've never seen a dust storm, I'd encourage people to look it up because it's like a wall of hot sand coming at you. And so there's a fire over there, there's a dust sandstorm coming us over here. So I was like, "Where can I hide the TV crew where I keep them safe?" Because that's part of my job as a media officer. So we went into this tent in this American part of the base, and I thought, "This is fine, we'll go in there." I'll do the zips up, I'll do the toggles up. It'll keep us safe from the dust and from the smoke. Mm. And I went in there, and of course, there's me, Julie Etchingham, who's very recognisable, the producer and the cameraman, full lights blazing, you know, recording. And it was a US Marine Corps toilet tent. And there was a poor chap sat there doing a number two, reading Stars and Stripes, looking up over his paper. What is this? And I'm there in my British uniform, like, hi, can we just borrow your tent? Sorry. And so, yes, so we obviously let him finish his business. And I was quite smug for about 10, 15 minutes because I thought, I've just saved everybody from the fire and the dust storm. But of course, you know, what is a dust storm? It's wind. What does wind do to a fire? It moves it. And so as the tent started to get a bit warmer and fill up with smoke, I was like, this might not be as safe as I thought. And so I went to try and get out, and the tent had actually started to get a bit too warm. And so I couldn't get the toggles out quick enough, and the zip was starting to effectively melt.
Oh my God.
And I was literally panicking, like, how am I going to get this? There's like all of us, plus my new best friend who just had the number two. How are we going to get us all out safely? And I had a little penknife. I had a very small penknife on my belt. And it's something that my dad gave me when I graduated officer college, because he said, you never know when you might need a little penknife when you're running around the world. And I had this tiny little, we're not talking like Crocodile Dundee big knife, like tiny little penknife. So I was trying to chip away at the tarpaulin, but it was enough to notice from the outside. And the US Marine Corps firefighters, who are literally like nothing on earth, with massive torch lights and big pieces of kit, put the much bigger knife through, cut through the tarpaulin, opened it up, and did the whole Arnie Schwarzenegger thing of come with me if you want to live. Reached inside the tent. We all leg it outside the tent, and then have a few more hours of adventure running through the smoke with the US Marine Corps. So I did not see that adventure coming, but it taught me how to not panic, because I could see all these sets of eyes looking at me like, well, you're the officer, you're in charge of us, what are we going to do? And your literally brain is flicking between self-preservation and looking after other people. And that's what I meant by becoming a better communicator and leader, because I emptied all my pockets, right? What have I got that might help us?
Yeah.
Pen knife, snack, pair of goggles, actually very helpful in a fire, keep the smoke out of your eyes. And so they actually did the same thing. They all did the same thing where they got their bits and pieces out and we put all the stuff on the table in front of us. But it was a calm moment. It was giving people something to do as a task to focus on. It was a good leadership lesson that I didn't appreciate at the time. But now with reflection, I'm like, oh, I did okay there because I got us all out alive.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a bit hairy.
Amazingly resourceful as well, like you say. Literally, what have we got to work with here? How can we literally combat the situation that we're in? And I'm laughing because it's humorous. I'm sure in that moment it must have been quite terrifying. The adrenaline.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing, is that there was a flash goes through my head that my parents and my friends would obviously get my death notice. And it's like, oh, you know, killed in action in Afghanistan, very noble. Yeah, no, she died in a toilet tent with a bloke that was doing a number two. I don't want that. I don't want that to be the way the universe remembers you. The legacy of Leslie Gore to die in the toilet tent. No, that's not me. So I'm not today. I'm not going to die today. And then I had Julie Etchingham, obviously very concerned. She had two young sons at the time. Mm. You know, I need to find a phone. I need to get out of here. I need to call my family. I want to make sure that I'm okay. And so you do go through an awful lot of emotions in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
But which is what being on the front line teaches you.
And why were you up a tree for Tom Cruise?
It's a little story. So I do a lot of film partnerships in my job. So we worked with James Bond, as you mentioned. We've also worked Mission Impossible with Paramount Pictures. And going back to 2015, I think it was, the Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, where he was filming the opening sequence of the film, he's on the side of a plane.
Yes, yes.
That was us. So he filmed for a week at RAF Wittering with us. And it wasn't green screen. He went up to 1,000 feet himself, strapped to the side of the plane, up and down, isn't he? Crazy. It was crazy. And so when he was there, obviously the world's media probably figured out where he was on the side of the A1 on this little tiny Air Force base. And the world's media were descending, and we'd put up sort of like fences and things around, but it's just a barbed wire fence on the side of the A1. And there were these trees. And in the newspapers, I won't name which one it was, there were some very grainy photos taken on long lenses of what looked like Tom Cruise, and we were trying to deny it was Tom Cruise. So I went out onto the perimeter and I looked for what I could see, because obviously understanding a bit about photography and camera work, I looked for what I thought was the angle. So I'm like, check, 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 no, not that one. And then I figured out where I thought the cameraman had climbed, and we then decided to tarpaulin that tree and make sure that you couldn't climb it.
Clever.
So, yeah.
Very clever. And throughout all of this, and obviously what I'm talking to you, because this is the Women of the Future podcast, the part of the programme, Have you had, has there been a standout moment or maybe a person in particular that you would say has helped inspire you or reaffirm that what you're doing is the right thing and could potentially be a mentor? Might just literally have been a moment in time. Have you had something like that happen in your career?
I haven't met a person in person. I'm a very bit of an odd reader. Now, when I was a kid, obviously consumed a lot of books, but I don't read fiction. All the books that are in my house are self-development books, leadership books, workbooks. And so the Brené Browns, the Simon Sinek's of this world, that's where I take my inspiration from. And obviously I love podcasts myself. So obviously Stephen Bartlett's Diary of a CEO is right up there as everybody's Bible for how to get through and become an entrepreneur. So those are the kind of things that I listen to and read and consume, and that's where I've taken my inspiration from. And the team at work that I have, they always know when I've read a new leadership book, as they say, because I'm experimenting on them.
It's interesting as well because one of Simon Sinek's most famous books is Start With Why, and you said that that was your first word, so maybe there's some kind of synergy there.
He's got another book called Leaders Eat Last. He's done a lot of work with the US Marine Corps, who I have worked with in operations, where he studied what we do very well in the military and how that can translate into civvy street. And obviously, leaders eat last. I mean, in the US Marine Corps, the higher the rank, the further down the queue you are. You're not first in the line at all. So it's quite nice.
And also in my mind, when hearing you say that, it's almost like parenting as well. But parenting can be a form of leadership in itself, can't it? So there's lots, again, like synergies and dualities in all of this. Across all of your work, is there any one thing that stands out for you or that you're particularly proud of?
I think I'm proud of having the courage to go to Afghanistan for the first time on my own. The thing about being a media and communications officer is most of the military deploy in what they call formed units, is like 20, 30, whatever of you. When you're a media and comms officer, you go on your own with a little camera bag. And I was offered a lift on a medical evacuation flight that was going into Afghanistan, picking up a patient from, I think it was Bagram Hospital, the American base, taking him to the British base because he needed an eye operation. And they were, so you can have a lift with us from Rise Norton from the C-17. So I literally flew with a bunch of medics who I'd never met before to a very faraway country in full body armor with a rifle and a couple of camera bags on my own, having just graduated college, the RAF college, I think 6 months prior. The officer rank tape was so small, it was a tiny piece of thread. You could barely see it. It was such a junior rank. And I remember feeling very, very frightened. But I was kind of like, do you know what? And I'd said to my family and my friends, I said, if anything happens to me, know that I chose to go, because I've always thought that on the other side of fear is the freedom. You know, I've reflected recently in sort of LinkedIn posts about my parents found a lot of pictures of me riding with stabilizers and things. And apparently I wanted to like tear them off and just go flying. And so, you know, people are trying to put safety measures on you to help you live a nice, comfortable life. And I've always been a bit of a rebel and thought, nah, I want to do the weird things. And both my parents were military medics. My uncles were engineers. My grandparents were medics. So when I joined up as a media officer, they were like, what's one of them? We don't get it. You know, it's, you're
What are
not
you
working with
doing?
things. Yeah. What is public relations? We don't understand. So yeah, I like to be different. I do like to be a bit maverick, to quote Top Gun.
It's interesting. I saw a quote recently. It might have been a meme or something like that, but it was along the lines of don't live the same day for 75 years and call it a life. And that's kind of what you're speaking to there, isn't it? But I know myself personally, when you do something that is out of your normal routine or out of like the daily grind or whatever, it can be hugely challenging. And like you just said, when you're on your own in particular, there's thought processes here, particularly in relation to the people that you love and care about and why you are taking this risk and why you're doing it and the meaning behind it. What is that like for you? What kind of things do you think about to mitigate and manage that? Because otherwise it can just be all consuming and make you want to go home.
So the secret for success that I've developed over the years, two part. Show up in the service of others and let go of the outcome. So if you are stuck in a, even stuck in that tent or stuck in other sort of hairy places around the world, if I look around at my team, how can I help them? How can I look after them? You get yourself out of the heat of the moment, both physically and mentally, and you start to have other thought processes going on, like, oh, I can help that person. I can look after that person. I can see something we could do over here. I was caught another time in Afghanistan. I was caught Christmas Eve. And we were being bombed by the Taliban, who knew that all Christians celebrate Christmas Eve. So I thought, great, let's give them some rockets. And on Kandahar airfield, in my media office, was just me and my photographer alone. And of course, when the rocket alarm goes off, you have to hit the deck, get under your desk, put your body armor on, sit there until you hear the all clear alarm. And it was going on for a very long time. And she was a bit younger than me. She'd not been away from home. I'd been a few times. And she was very, very nervous and very, very scared. So I thought, actually, what can I do to help her be less scared? And so because it was Christmas, we had members of the public sending in those little lovely gift boxes, shoe boxes full of toiletries and treats and stuff. We'd had some. So I opened one and it had a puzzle in it. It was a kitten puzzle. I think it was kittens playing with balls of wool, that old stereotype. And we literally lay there on the floor in full body armor with the puzzle pieces doing this thing until we heard the all clear alarm, because it took the focus away. And it was mindfulness effectively in that moment. So I was always grateful to, I like to think it was some little old granny that put that in a shoebox for us one day. But those are the kind of things that show up in the service of others, but let go of the outcome, because in storytelling, it will never pan out exactly as you think it will. You think you're going on a story as a journalist or as a media officer, and it will never pan out like that. It will never land that way. There's always something going to change. And so if you are too wedded to the outcome, you will just make yourself more stressed.
That's very, very staunch advice. How did you first hear about the Women of the Future programme? And I know that you've spoken at their summits previously, but how do you work with them?
So I found Pinky's posts on LinkedIn, and I thought, what an amazing woman. Again, like, you know, you're reading books like Brené Brown, you know, here's this woman who's done all these amazing, innovative things in her career. And I just connected with her, and I just started messaging her and saying, you know, if anything I can ever do, I've got a slightly different lens of way of looking things. And obviously, I would love to be of service and to help. And because I'm a serving member of the military, I don't take a speaker fee, so I speak for free. Right. And I do it because I believe in giving back to the community. And it's obviously part of my day job as well. And she just said, oh, actually, do you fancy coming in and having a chat, I think she said, one day. And then when I got the message from her team, it was like, yes, so you're going to have this 1 hour masterclass with 100 women. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm used to doing 20 minute keynotes. What does that look like? Oh, they need exercises, and you've got to do this, you've got to be on stage for an hour. And I was like, again, I've never done it before, but I'm going to say yes and just feel the fear anyway. And I absolutely loved it. And we even went off piste, went off script, and we ended up chatting about all things like menopause and being a woman on the front line and being a woman in what's perceived as a man's world. So because I'd written my lesson plan for the hour, but I had room to deviate, so again, that flexibility, we loved it. We had some amazing conversations and I met some awesome people. It was really cool.
It's very inspiring, isn't it? I have some quick fire questions for you just to finish, if that's okay.
Of course.
Here we go. What would you describe as your greatest success?
My fearlessness.
And your greatest failure?
My rumination. I ruminate for too long.
Okay, interesting. The mantra of Woman of the Future is kindness and collaboration. What does that mean to you in both your personal and professional life?
I would say lift as you rise. I don't like women that pull the ladder up behind them. And I always think that women owe it to other women to help them rise around them. Collaboration, I think, is curiosity, being open, never assuming that you know it all. There's always something you could learn. I mean, I'm a Gen X leader with millennials and Gen Z in my team. And having somebody work for me who's 25 years younger than me is incredibly eye-opening, and she's awesome. And she teaches me as well as I teach her. So I think it's that relationship.
I had this situation on my own team the other day where I taught this young lady who Burt Bacharach was, and she told me what Bay meant. So I felt like that was useful interaction.
That's collaboration.
I also think the day that you stop learning would be a really sad day. And I don't think you should ever, come to that conclusion or have to be faced with that kind of situation. But is there anything that scares you?
Not taking the chance. I think it's the roads not taken that scare me rather than the actual ones I have done. And I don't ever want to stop. I'm 48 now. I'm in menopause when the military's not cut out for menopausal women. So I'm considering myself a bit of a trailblazer. I want to help clear the runway for those who come after me so they don't have to hit some of the same hurdles.
I think I completely agree with that. And sometimes it's worth having a difficult conversation or putting yourself or making yourself uncomfortable, like you say, just so that it might not be as uncomfortable for someone that comes after you. What's left on your to-do list?
Ooh, I've actually got quite a big job in front of me. So, for example, the young chap that just won Traitors, I say young chap, sounds very patronising, he's 23. He is still serving in the British Army. He's now leaving the British Army, or leave later this year, to become an Instagram influencer and do other things. Not something I ever thought. There was no valid life career choice when I was his age to become an influencer. So whilst he is still serving, he obviously wants to do more influence work and potentially earn money and do more things like the TV reality shows. That's never been done before. So I'm actually rewriting policy, defence policy, to allow our members of the armed forces to actually become influencers whilst they are still serving, because normally it's like, don't do social media because you might say something wrong. So actually empowering and helping educate our people, the US armed forces do it beautifully and I can learn from them. So I want my legacy to be that I have rewritten it and made it easier for people coming after me to be influencers and to have social media campaigns while still serving the military. The two should not be mutually exclusive.
That's very inspiring. I'm going to chuck in an extra bonus speed question here, but I love the phrase that you use about combating creative constipation. And it just may be because it's humorous again, but is there any tip, or maybe tips two or three, that you would just offer, if you're able, to try and get people to, in storytelling as well, to be more creative and to break through any kind of barrier they might be facing?
So I think the thing about creativity is you never know where it's going to come from, and don't ever be afraid of trying to please other people. So I did a partnership in 2019 with Disney. Defence does Disney, not someone ever thought that was going to come. That was for Captain Marvel for International Women's Day. And Disney wanted to partner with Love Island. Now, my director at the time, middle-aged white man who did not like Love Island, was almost fell off his chair when I pitched the idea to him. And it was a real piece of hard work to say, please, I really think this would be amazing for us. We'll reach new audiences. I'll make sure I look after these ladies. They won't say anything inappropriate. We're going to dress them up in fast jet uniform and let them sit in a fast jet, etc. And we did do it, and it worked very well for us and for Disney. But I think it's having the courage of your convictions. I could have easily been swayed by that director saying, don't be silly, we don't do stuff like that. We're with the Ministry of Defence. Why not?
Yeah.
Why not? So don't be afraid to just try and be the maverick, buck the norm a little bit and give it a go.
Leslie, thank you so much. It's been brilliant speaking to you. I could ask you like a zillion other questions. Unfortunately, we don't have time, but I really appreciate you being a part of this podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to chat.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Women of the Future podcast. If you enjoyed it, please hit the subscribe button. And while you're there, why not give us a rating and review? You know you want to. For more about the Women of the Future Awards, network and initiative, please visit www.womenofthefuture.co.uk. See you soon.